The following teleconference is recorded for Deborah Ness with PR Solutions Incorporated on Tuesday, March 21st, 2017, beginning at 11:15 a.m. Eastern Time, 10:15 a.m. Central Time. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your patience in holding. We now have your speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of today's presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instructions will be given as to the procedure to follow if you would like to ask a question. It is now my pleasure to turn today's conference over to Lauren Segor. Ma'am, you may begin.
Great. Thank you very much, Brandon, and thank you, everyone, for joining us today. My name is Lauren Segor, and I'm with the National Partnership for Women and Families, and we're very pleased to be hosting this sixth in a seven-part series of calls about the Affordable Care Act and efforts to repeal it and the damage that that would potentially do to many. So today's topic will focus on essential health benefits and the impact of the proposed American Health Care Act on those benefits, as well as other ways that they could potentially be undermined. And we will be running this call for 30 minutes, so we will have three speakers who will speak for about 15 minutes, and then we will open the floor to questions for about 15 minutes. And I'm going to go ahead and introduce our three speakers. We have Deborah L. Ness, the president of the National Partnership for Women and Families, followed by Alice Demner, Director of the Substance Use Disorders Project at Community Catalyst, followed by Carl Schmidt, the Deputy Executive Director of the AIDS Institute. At this point, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Ms. Ness to get us started.
Hi, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us today. Again, I'm Deborah Ness with the National Partnership for Women and Families. We're going to try to cover three aspects of the essential health benefits discussion. First of all, what they are. Secondly, why they're so important. And we will provide some specific examples in the maternity care area, the mental health and substance use area, and prescription drugs. And then we will talk about what the American Health Care Act means for these essential health benefits and what some of the looming threats are. So I'll start by saying what they are, and quite simply, the essential health benefits are the categories of health care that are considered essential to any kind of basic insurance coverage. The Affordable Care Act established 10 basic categories of care that they said every health plan had to include to be considered a qualified plan. And those 10 basic areas are ambulatory care, hospitalization, ER, pediatrics care, pregnancy maternity care, prescription drug coverage, mental health and substance abuse, lab services, preventive services, and rehabilitation and habilitative services. For those of us who've had comprehensive coverage, you've been lucky enough to have comprehensive health insurance coverage, for the most part, those are all services we take for granted are going to be covered by our plan. But for many, it was the first time that they could have the guarantee that when they bought insurance, they would have a plan that covered all 10 of those areas. The Affordable Care Act also gave states some flexibility in this area. While those 10 benefit categories are defined in statute, what then happened in the regulatory process is HHS said that states could define the scope of services within each of those categories by benchmarking themselves to a typical employer plan in their states. And the idea there was that the plans that qualified under the Affordable Care Act would be similar to typical employer plans. So that's what they are. Why are they so important? Well, from a women's perspective, one of the best examples I can give you is maternity care. Prior to the Affordable Care Act, most plans on the individual market did not cover maternity care services at all. In fact, the number is only 12% of plans. And even in those states that actually had requirements that plans had to cover certain categories of care, there were only a dozen states that actually included maternity care as part of those requirements. So very few women of childbearing age on the individual market were able to get a plan with maternity care covered. And even if they did, often the coverage was pretty pathetic. Sometimes the coverage was made so expensive it took the form of you could get the plan, but you had to pay an extra rider in order to get the coverage. In some plans, you had a deductible for maternity care that was as high as $10,000. And we know the average cost of a private insurance birth is $21,000. Back in 2009, before the ACA, you even had women who got plans with insurance coverage often got a plan that said they covered maternity, and it wasn't until they actually had a birth that they discovered that the plan might have capped the amount they covered at something like $3,000. Well, $3,000 doesn't go very far when the average birth costs $21,000. So, the American Healthcare Act that the House is trying to pass now actually do to these essential health benefits? Well, for those in Medicaid expansion who got covered that way, it basically phases out the requirement that there be essential health benefits in every plan. But beyond that, for everyone else, they cannot completely eliminate essential health benefits because that's a statutory requirement. So we would need new legislation to eliminate the requirement that there be these 10 categories of essential health benefits. Instead, what this American Healthcare Act does is it changes the standards for plans. It actually changes something called their actuarial value standards, which means that they now have the flexibility to change the kind of out-of-pocket costs that people would face for certain kinds of services. That means they can play around with deductibles, with co-pays, with co-insurance, and they can once again go back to making these basic services unaffordable. So if they really don't want to provide maternity care, for example, they can actually cost that almost out of reach for most women. So the American Healthcare Act does its own damage, and looking ahead beyond this current debate, we can see that regulatorily HHS can also do additional damage because HHS defines the way in which states have to benchmark their essential health benefits. So once we get past this legislative debate, there is further damage that HHS can do by giving states more flexibility to peg their qualified plans to a much lower standard of care. I'm going to end there and pass it on to my colleague, Alice. Alice Dedner is with Community Catalyst, and she's going to talk now about the importance of essential health benefits to substance use and mental health disorders.
Thank you so much, Deborah, and thank you all for attending this press conference. So I think I want to stress that the bottom line for people with substance use disorders, or what we used to call substance abuse, is that the American Healthcare Act would undermine efforts to address those problems and to address our national crisis of opioid overdose deaths. And the way that would do that is, I think I want to step back for a moment and just talk, you know, to acknowledge that I'm going to talk about mostly about essential health benefits and the Medicaid expansion. Refresh what I'm sure you all know, which is that the American Health Care Act would repeal the Medicaid expansion. And that expansion has enabled at least 1.3 million people, and we think the number is probably higher, to get treatment for substance use disorders and mental illness. So that's 1.3 million people who could immediately be thrown off treatment, and we also know that about 9 million more people got coverage under the Medicaid expansion who may not currently be getting treatment for substance use disorders or mental illness, but who could be at some point in the future faced by one of these medical conditions. In addition, and in the meantime, because the Medicaid expansion would be phased out under this health bill over the next few years, the House version of the bill would repeal the requirement that coverage for the Medicaid expansion population include the essential health benefits. So this would return us to a time when many states did not cover anything more than detoxification for people with substance use. So just to give you a comparison, that's like covering only the first week of chemotherapy for a cancer patient. So that would be a national tragedy happening at the same time we're fighting an opioid epidemic that killed 30,000 people last year. Most people with substance use need a range of services that include what we call harm reduction, such as the life-saving overdose reversal drug, naloxone. It includes detoxification, inpatient treatment, therapy, medicine to counteract the effects of opioids, residential treatment, and long-term recovery support services. So if we're talking about returning to a time when plans only cover detox, we're in trouble. So the Republican health care bill would also severely weaken provisions of a separate federal law called the Parity Law that requires that coverage of substance use disorders and mental illness in Medicaid expansion be on a par with coverage of other illnesses such as cancer or diabetes. The law is officially called the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act and was passed in 2008 prior to the Affordable Care Act. So the way that the GOP bill would weaken this is that the federal parity law only applies if a Medicaid program offers substance use or mental health coverage. It does not require that that treatment be offered. And so the effect of the parity law was much strengthened by the fact that there was this essential health benefit requirement and that exists now. It works hand in glove with that essential health benefit requirement, saying not only must you offer these services, but you must offer them on a par with the coverage of other medical diseases. So even if a state, for example, if a state doesn't cover right now prescription, let me step back a minute. So because the Parity Law operates hand in glove with essential health benefits, the Parity Law also applies by category of care. So it looks at whether there's parity by basis on like looking at emergency care and looking at inpatient care and looking at outpatient care as categories, or looking at prescription drugs. So, for example, if a state didn't offer coverage of prescription medicines for substance use, then the parity law wouldn't apply. So they wouldn't have to be equal with medical because there weren't any at all, and that was taken out of the picture. So this basically means that there really is not a lot of leverage to require comprehensive treatment if we eliminate the essential health benefit requirement. I also want to turn back to private insurance for a minute. So as Deborah said, so far the administration has not said that it would do away with the essential health benefit requirement, nor have the congressional Republicans. But as Deborah discussed, it could certainly be weakened by making those services unaffordable. And if the administration does go ahead and revise regulations on essential health benefits for private insurance plans, they could certainly weaken them. And we know that the governors of some Republican governors across the country have weighed in asking for that change to happen. So that, I think, is potentially looming on the horizon. And I want to stress that just like in Medicaid before the Affordable Care Act expansion, there was pretty paltry coverage of substance use disorders and mental illness in most private coverage. I would say that was exactly the same case in the private insurance as it was in Medicaid. In both cases, the coverage was pretty skimpy. Now we have private plans that are, because of the Affordable Care Act, are covering much more in the way of substance use and mental illness treatment. But that would all go away if we did not have essential, or most of that would go away if we didn't have essential health benefits or we had weaker standards. And the bottom line, again, is that many people would lose life-saving coverage for substance use disorders and mental illness. With that, I will pass the mic here to Carl.
Great, thanks. I'm going to be talking about the important role of prescription drugs. And you can imagine the AIDS Institute represents people living with HIV and with hepatitis. And the role of prescription drugs is just so important for those two populations. With people living with HIV, they need access to medications every single day. And now with hepatitis C, we actually have a cure thanks to the new medications. But, you know, so many other illnesses as well. Cancer, MS, epilepsy, mental health, the list goes on. Prescription drugs are just so important to patients, and that's why we were, you know, pleased that prescription drugs was, you know, identified as one of the 10 essential health benefits that every plan has to cover. And not as bad as maternal health, but 20% of the plans before the ACA did not, individual market plans, did not offer prescription drugs. Unlike employer plans that almost all of them do. But we're very concerned if we lose prescription drug benefit and as part of the essential health benefits, you know, in devolve that to the states, let them choose, you know, to offer more slimmed down plans. You know, you frequently hear to give patients more choices. Well, you know, what if plans offer, come out and offer no prescription drugs? And people, you know, it may be very attractive to them because the cost would be lower. You know, they may not need, you know, I don't have HIV, I don't have hepatitis, I don't have cancer, but who knows what you're going to have tomorrow? You could develop cancer, you could have HIV or hepatitis. People don't know what they need in the future. And I think that's the whole, you know, reason for health insurance and to have essential health benefits, to have access to those benefits that are deemed essential and to spread the risk around to a large population to keep costs down. So, you know, as Deborah said, the current congressional plan does not repeal essential health benefits in the individual market plans, but it does eliminate the actual value that all plans have to meet, which provides an opening to plans to cut back on the benefits. And we've already heard Secretary Price and others in Congress talk about bringing back the essential health benefits to the state level to address individual state needs and to cut back on federal regulations. And that really worries us. I really don't know what the difference is between a beneficiary in California and, for example, one in Delaware when it comes to prescription drugs. Patients need the drugs that their providers prescribe. In the ACA, you know, it was very simple language that, you know, listed prescription drugs as one of the essential health benefits. But we've really relied on the federal regulations and guidance since the law passed to make sure plans cover the drugs that patients need. It's really important, to get drugs on the formularies for both the patient and the providers. Through regulation, you know, the HHS has said that plans can't design their formulary that discriminate based on someone's health status, age, or disability. They have to cover a minimum of drugs in each class based on a state's benchmark plan. And now they have to update each plan has to be updated to consider newly approved drugs and treatment guidelines. There's an exceptions and appeals process. There has to be transparency requirements so that patients could determine their cost and tiering and utilization management techniques like prior authorizations and step therapy. And we're concerned if we lose essential health benefits at the federal level and these federal regulations, we could lose these common sense patient protections. Also, we're concerned about who is defining discrimination. We've seen lots of examples of plans putting all drugs to treat a certain condition on the highest tier, not covering certain drugs or excessive prior authorization. So we believe there must be some level of federal protection for patients. And finally, as we heard, the bill being considered on the Hill right now does repeal essential health benefits for the expanded Medicaid population. This is really disconcerting, obviously, to us. Medicaid recipients need drugs just like everyone else. And since they're cutting money for Medicaid and placing per capita caps or now black grants, states may not have the money for drugs, particularly like new treatments for hepatitis C or cancer. So we're going to continue to fight for federal essential health benefits, not only for drugs, but all for the other categories as well, because we believe all are essential for patients and their health. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carl. That was great. I think, Brandon, at this point, we're ready to open up the line for questions.
Yes, ma'am. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please dial the star key, followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they're received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please dial star 2. Again, to ask a question, please dial star 1 now. We are currently holding for questions.
So, Brandon, while we're waiting to see if anyone has a question, I think I would like to make a couple of additional points. I think when you listen to what Alice and Carl and I had to say, what you really see is that a lot of this discussion about cutting costs, making care more affordable through the American Health Care Act, is really about cutting back on the benefits people would get in the coverage that they would now be able to afford. You can't have it both ways. If we're talking about cutting costs, we're also, unfortunately, probably talking about going backwards to a time when it's the plans that get to decide what they cover, who gets covered, and they do that by manipulating the out-of-pocket costs that people pay, the deductibles, the coinsurance, the copays. And what you heard in the examples from Carl and Alice are examples where, in effect, plans get to pick and choose who it is they cover by virtue of the way they manipulate the benefits. And whether it's discriminating against people with HIV/AIDS because it's too expensive to cover their drugs, or it's discriminating against people who you know have a history of substance abuse, or it's discriminating against women because they might get pregnant. You can find ways to make your plan less attractive to those populations, but cheaper to other populations. And it flies in the face of the basic idea behind insurance, where it should be all about spreading risk and making it affordable for everybody. It's particularly worrisome that we have had folks like our new CMS administrator call out certain things like maternity and say maybe we don't need plans that offer things like maternity care. And that's why the concerns that we've raised and that Carl just amplified about what could happen in the regulatory process are particularly dangerous. So the American Health Care Act opens the door, and the regulatory process could really decimate the protections we have in place.
We have a question from Bill Kibler with Altoona Mira. Please go ahead.
I guess this is for Deborah, who just spoke. What would motivate a health plan to discriminate against any particular population?
Well, the cost. If you can avoid older, sicker populations or expensive populations, you can offer cheaper coverage, cheaper plans, and then you can make a higher profit margin. You bring in the young and healthy. It's called cherry picking. You bring in the young and healthy, yes, you can offer cheaper plans. But then you leave the folks who are older and sicker in a much more expensive risk pool to insure. And so for those folks, whoever does cover them, they have to offer coverage that's much more expensive, and so the costs go up for those people.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. The next question will come from Anthony Moriano with Crud TV FM. Please go ahead.
This is for Deborah. Could you elaborate a little bit more about how you feel that companies could discriminate against women in coverage?
So it's really the same answer. It's by manipulating the kinds of deductibles and co-pays and co-insurance that women would have to pay. So you may remember I gave the example of back before the Affordable Care Act was passed, there were plans that said you had a $10,000 deductible before they covered any expenses for maternity care. Obviously, if the average birth is about $21,000, you're expecting that individual to pay an awful lot of out-of-pocket. Makes that plan very unattractive to anybody who thinks that they might need maternity coverage. Because this is specifically something that affects women, it also makes that a fairly discriminatory practice. And it's what we call rating. And in some other places, you'd call it redlining.
I have another question, if that's all right.
Sure.
I'm calling from New Mexico, and the state, there are hundreds of thousands of people who rely on Medicaid to get health care. And I was also, and it's also a state that is dealing with a serious substance abuse issue as well. I was wondering, could you kind of give us a little perspective about what the American Health Care Act in its current form right now being discussed could have an impact on a state like New Mexico that's dealing with those two things?
Maybe Carl can take that.
Alice, do you want to start?
Yeah.
Yes, I think that would be great. So this is Alice Demner from Community Catalyst, and I work extensively on substance use issues. So I think that the impact, I think, could be devastating on states like New Mexico, which are really struggling to cope with the level of substance use, and particularly opioid overdoses that are happening in their communities, because it would really pull the rug out from under states in terms of their Medicaid programs in particular, by really undermining the effort through whether it's through the per capita formulas that were in the original version of the bill or the Medicaid block grant cap that is now being discussed as an alternative. So under either of those versions, the states would get a lot less money from the federal government. The original cut was estimated at $880 billion nationally over the next 10 years to states. So you're talking about a lot less money and matching money coming to the states for Medicaid in particular, so leaving the state to pick up much more of the tab. New Mexico, as you know, is one of the states that has expanded Medicaid to the low-income population of individuals who do not have children. And there's lots of needy folks in New Mexico and elsewhere, many of whom have problems with substances, and they're getting treatment for the first time. So what could result is that a lot of people are thrown off coverage or no longer have those benefits, or the state is going to have to step up and find that money elsewhere. And I know that New Mexico is particularly challenged by budget issues right now, as are some other states. So the state's going to have to either dig deeper, or you're going to see those people, more people, unfortunately, dying, not getting access to the life-saving treatment that they need, and the consequences of that for their families, the communities, and also that's an impact on state and local budgets. They're going to be forced to have to step up and find other ways to try to help the New Mexico folks who are suffering from these diseases.
Showing nothing further in the queue at this time.
Okay, I think we can go ahead and end the call there.
So thank you, everyone, again for joining, and many thanks to our speakers today for their time and expertise on this issue. I think most of you on the call do have contact information for us, so feel free to follow up if you have additional questions, and we'll direct them to the right person. And otherwise, thank you again. We hope you'll consider joining the last in this series, which will be this Thursday, same time, 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time, and the focus of that call will be on the effect of the American Health Care Act on older adults. So we look forward to reconnecting then, and thank you again for your time.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's call. You may now disconnect your lines. Have a great afternoon.